From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with writer James Lardner. His new book, Fast Forward, explains how the video cassette recorder evolved from a technological marvel to a common consumer item, and how the rise of the VCR affected everything from show business to big business. Also today, I'll talk with film director Tim Hunter. His new movie, River's Edge, is the disturbing story of a teenage murderer and his friends who keep his secret. TV critic David Bianculli says ABC's decision to cancel Our World means the world of TV just got a little duller. And our jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new album by pianist Steve Kuhn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me now is James Lardner, author of the new book, Fast Forward, Hollywood, the Japanese, and the Onslaught of the VCR. It traces the history of the device that has revolutionized home television viewing and looks at the repercussions it has had in Hollywood and throughout the electronics industry. In 1976, the video cassette recorder was a cumbersome luxury item that sold for about $1,400. Since then, 33 million of them have been sold, as prices have fallen to as low as $200. Lardner's new book traces how the Japanese became the sole manufacturers of a device that relied on American technology. He also explores the movie industry's fear of home taping and the legal battles it initiated for copyrights and royalties. Lardner also examines how the VCR has changed not only what we see at home, but what we watch in movie theaters. James Lardner is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and in case you're wondering about the name, he's the son of screenwriter Ring Lardner Jr. and the grandson of sports writer Ring Lardner. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
It's really amazing how the VCR went from a luxury item to just a common home appliance almost overnight.
Well, it's hard even to keep up with those statistics. You said 33 million. I think it's probably close to 50 million now, and it's close to half the homes in America have these appliances.
What made you see the video cassette recorder as a good subject to actually examine a lot of larger issues?
For one thing, it is a machine that is made exclusively in Japan, except for a few made in Korea. So it's a glaring example, I guess, of the whole competitiveness problem. Even though you can walk into a store and buy a VCR that says Zenith or GE or RCA on it, those machines are all made in Japan, basically. And yet 30 years ago, the video tape recorder was invented by an American company for broadcasters' use to conquer the problem of the time zone gap between the East Coast and the West Coast. And the American industry just lost it, the edge.
The film industry, Hollywood, was really terrified of home taping and of home viewing when the VCRs were first manufactured. What were some of the fears that the film industry had about the effect of video cassette recorders?
Well, the theory was, as expressed by Jack Valenti, the president of the Motion Picture Association and others, that if it became possible for people to easily make their own copies of movies, principally by copying movies off the air, movies that were broadcast over the television waves, that then the so-called aftermarket, the re-release of movies in theaters, the sale of movies to cable TV and so forth would just dry up, and the movie companies would lose revenue, and then they would lose the ability to finance new movies, and the rate of production of new movies would decline. Nothing could be further from the truth. This year, I believe, the number of American movies is considerably up from last year, and one reason that is widely cited is that you can now independently produce a movie and put together a budget without going to one of the big Hollywood studios. One of the biggest pieces of that budget will be the money you get for the home video rights. The rental of pre-recorded movies on video cassettes has become such a large part of the industry, more than network television now.
Some movies actually have a stronger second life in home rental than they had in their first life in the movie theaters. What are some examples?
Well, I think the most appalling example probably is Heaven's Gate, which made much more money, I think, in video than it did in theaters. I don't know of so many cases of that exactly. What I do know of are cases of movies whose producers trooped around trying to raise the money for a whole lot of time and then finally succeeded by selling the home video rights before they'd ever made the movie. A movie like Platoon, for example, probably never would have been made unless a company called Vestron Video had put up several million dollars for it, something like half its production cost.
So the video industry is helping to finance part of the movie industry. Are the demographics of moviegoing changing because of the video cassettes? Here's what I'm thinking. A lot of people would think that adults are staying home to watch videos on Saturday night, so the market becomes more and more teenage-oriented. I mean, is that true? Is that why we're seeing so many teenage-directed movies in the theaters now?
I think so. I think that the Steven Spielberg phenomenon is, to some extent, traceable to video. Although it's true that more movies can now be made, and this can apply to serious movies like Platoon that I mentioned, as well as to horror movies and many other kinds of B-movie fare, I think that a larger and larger portion of the people who go out to the movies are either teenagers or young adults for the reasons you expressed. So it means that a lot of adults will have to see their movies in video because the movies they want to see will be either never in the theaters at all or in the theaters very briefly.
Something that really surprised me in your book was the observation that initially pornography was responsible for a lot of the profits in home video rentals. But now children's video has become, I think, as profitable as pornography has been?
Well, Hollywood had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this medium. And one of the ways in which they were dragged was by seeing that pornographers and also pirates, illegal copiers of movies, got in there ahead of them. So the studios were frightened that if they didn't make this commitment, that there would be an illegal market in their movies, and all the harm would still exist, but none of the benefit. So they decided to plunge in. And although I don't think pornography has exactly – the pornographic side of the video business hasn't exactly dried up, it's become a smaller and smaller and smaller percentage of the business overall. And children's movies, on the other hand, have the virtue that a lot of parents want to use video as a kind of babysitter. But also there turns out to be a real hunger for an alternative to the Saturday morning cartoon-type programs. Video gives parents the ability to control what it is their children are going to watch.
So has Hollywood made its peace with the video cassette recorder?
I think you could say that. A sign of it is that every movie studio has a large subdivision now busily making works solely for distribution in video or largely for distribution in video.
It's funny because we all have, I think, the preconception that a new technology comes along and it displaces the technologies that were there before it. You know, so we thought, well, here comes the video cassette recorders and certain television programs and certain kinds of movies are going to become obsolete.
Well, and of course, when television came along, people thought radio would suffer that fate. And I think radio stations are worth more now than they ever were. I regret to put it in those crude terms when I'm talking on public radio. Hollywood was pretty scared of television. Movies made some adjustments in the 50s, you'll remember. For example, there was 3D and there was CinemaScope and widescreen processes. And it will be interesting to see what it is they do now, what they can do as people's in-home video viewing room setups become fancier and fancier and the quality of the sound improves. What will movie theaters do? Will there be holographic movies or 360-degree round movies, or how will they, you know, better what can be had in the home?
My guest is James Lardner. He's the author of a new book called Fast Forward, which is about video cassette recorders and their repercussions in business and in entertainment. An observation you make in your book, and I wonder if this jives with our listeners' experiences, is that a lot of people get video cassette recorders at the same time that they buy cable, and they figure that they'll be able to tape all the great movies from cable and watch them at their convenience. And then eventually they find that it's more convenient to rent the movies, and they end up discontinuing their cable subscription.
Well, there were a lot of futurologists who predicted that cable television would be phenomenally successful, and it seemed quite beautiful on the technological level because you would deliver programs to people's homes without actually having to create a permanent copy. And the video store seemed really cumbersome by contrast. You have to go get this box at the store and you have to carry it home. Very backward kind of 19th century. But it turns out that people actually kind of like to go to the store and handle the video cassettes and see what there is and talk to the salespeople. And most of all, then, have control over the time at which they watch each particular program. Also, they have a much wider assortment of things they can choose from. And so a lot of people have gotten their, you know, cable, and then they've discovered that, you know, there are things on at all kinds of hours that they don't necessarily want to watch at 3 in the morning. So they buy a VCR to tape off cable, and then eventually they discover that they prefer going and renting movies at the video store, which costs them, you know, X number of dollars a month, to having to pay $25 a month in a cable subscription fee.
So cable is worried about video still.
Yeah.
About video recorders, I mean.
I think, you know, the cable industry has been in a kind of stalling pattern for the last few years, and that's a large part of the reason.
I'm one of the viewers who, when I tape a program from TV, I fast forward through the commercials. And
me too.
Yeah, I'm sure we're not the only ones. Is television doing anything to try to prevent us from doing that? It can't be good for the advertisers to think that people who are taping aren't watching their commercials.
Well, television is not an institution that kind of speaks with one voice. So that you can answer your question in two ways. Television is doing something in the sense that forms of television that don't depend on commercial sponsorship are coming to take over more of the audience. Public television, cable television. Commercially sponsored network television is doing something in another sense. They are, on the one hand, they are trying to make commercials that are epic productions in the Spielberg and Lucas style that people will feel riveted to and will not, you know, will want to watch. Burger King has also developed a series of commercials that are actually designed to be comprehensible if viewed at a high speed on a VCR. And at the same,
how do they do that?
I don't know exactly. You see the letters, you know, stay on the screen a long time so that you get the message even if you're viewing it in fast speed. At the same time, the other way in which they're responding is that they're coming to terms with the fact that they are going to have to occupy a less privileged place in the communication scheme of things, and their budgets may have to go down. And that's why video has some role in all the cutbacks you see at CBS and ABC and NBC.
Well, commercials have become the equivalent of little movies. I'm thinking of the unveiling of the campaign for the new Michael Jackson commercial. It gets as much publicity as a new movie does.
Yeah, I would like to fess up to personally not being very fond of the whole idea of commercial sponsorship, and hoping that video will over time have some role in bringing about its demise.
When video cassette recorders were first becoming available, I think the industry's idea was that people would run out and buy movies. How did rentals win out over purchases?
Totally without the encouragement of the movie industry. There was this one guy named George Atkinson who started a store in Los Angeles, and right away he thought rentals was the way to go. His reasoning for it was that you don't want to watch a movie over and over and over again. Most people don't, and that's different from the record business. I suppose Hollywood hoped, and to some extent it's turning out to be true, that people would want to have big movie collections for prestige in the same way that some people have, you know, grand-looking libraries of books that they never look at. But the better analogy was the record industry. And the problem was that the essential difference. People want to listen to music over and over again. They don't want to watch movies over and over again. And they watch movies at a rate that makes it, you know, hugely expensive if you were to buy every movie you ever wanted to watch. So this guy set up a store and charged initially like $10 a rental and did quite a good business, in spite of the fact that 20th Century Fox, the first company that put its movies on videos, told him, absolutely not, we don't want you renting. And eventually he discovered that they had no right to stop him.
I think you're one of the few people who actually knows the history of video membership clubs.
Well, it is true that Atkinson and other people like him charged a tidy sum to join their clubs. And the reason they did it in many cases was that the stores themselves were undercapitalized, and it was a good way of getting a lot of cash up front. And after a few years, some big operators like Tower Video started opening up stores that didn't charge membership fees. And when this happened, the stores that did charge membership fees in those same cities in many cases ran into trouble, and one result you see now is that more and more stores have no membership or have a membership that essentially costs nothing.
This is Fresh Air, and my guest is James Lardner. We're talking about his new book, which is about video cassette recorders. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is James Lardner, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Fast Forward, which is about how the video cassette recorder has changed big business and show business. Let's talk about the technology of the video cassette recorder. As you mentioned earlier, the American electronics industry had come up with video recorders years before the Japanese did, yet, as you pointed out, the Japanese are the sole manufacturers of it now. How did America miss the boat on that?
Well, I would offer a couple of explanations. Masaru Ibuka, who was the founder of Sony, a company, incidentally, that was founded at the end of World War II in the charred remains of a department store in Tokyo, just as a kind of radio repair shop. He said once to some American electronics executive, he said, what ruined your electronics industry was space and defense. And I think he meant that our electronics industry, the American electronics industry, was oriented towards making products for space and defense, products in which cost was really almost immaterial because the government would pay whatever the cost was. And ease of use and ease of maintenance was almost immaterial because the Pentagon was willing, always wanted to be at the frontiers of technology and was willing to buy products that needed lavish maintenance. The Japanese electronics industry, by contrast, has been directed at consumer products exclusively. This is partly something, I mean, this is a favor we did them at the end of World War II. We told them they were not going to have a military, so they haven't had that to worry about. And they are very consumer-oriented. And you almost get a reverse of the much-talked-about phenomenon of the trickle-down benefits of high-tech from space and defense eventually filtering down into consumer products. Well, now it's kind of turned around. And you get the benefits of consumer products trickling back into space and defense. Now I'm told that something like 40% of the electronics innards of American weapon systems are now made in Japan. That's one main explanation.
One of the things that surprises me is after the video cassette recorder was perfected by Japanese companies, why didn't American companies figure out how to do it and start making their own? You say that there are currently no American manufacturers who are actually making the VCR.
Well, the transistor and semiconductors is an explanation of some of this. You know, the transistor is another American invention that American industry didn't quite know what to do with. And it was Sony, by the way, that bought the rights to use the transistor to make transistors from AT&T, essentially, back in the early 50s. And the people at AT&T at the time had no real idea what to do with this technology. The only consumer product then being made that was transistorized in the United States was a hearing aid. And an official of Western Electric, the AT&T research arm, told the people at Sony, you know, we suggest you make hearing aids. Here's a product that you realistically could make, very patronizingly. Sony, on the other hand, immediately saw that hearing aids was not a product with a lot of money in it. Radios was what they thought of making. And actually, an American company was the first to make the transistorized radio. But Sony was the first to make the so-called pocket-sized transistorized radio in about 1956, 57. Smallness, miniaturization has been a kind of part of the Japanese culture for hundreds of years. In fact, it can nearly be said thousands of years. In something like 300 A.D., the Japanese Empress Jingu is supposed to have invented the folding fan, the folding paper fan. The Chinese and the Koreans had invented the flat fan, and the Japanese figured out how to fold it up. She was inspired by the wings of a bat.
But you'd figure even if the Japanese invented this miniaturized technology that the American manufacturers would jump on the bandwagon and come up with their own versions of it.
Well, American manufacturers have been pretty content in a lot of cases to buy technology from outside and make a good profit by reselling it. I mean, RCA is an example of a company that tried very hard to market a video recorder-like product, lost hundreds of millions of dollars on a video disc system that was based on a miscalculation that consumers would buy a product that could only play and could not record. And now RCA is only too happy to buy Japanese-made VCRs, you know, turn a profit on selling them.
So when someone wants to, quote, buy American and they pick up a VCR with an American brand name on it, are they definitely getting a Japanese product that is just being distributed by an American company?
All the VCRs sold in America are either made in Japan or in Korea. A few companies are doing the final assembly processes in the United States. That's all.
My guest is James Lardner, and we're discussing his new book on VCRs, which is called Fast Forward. Did you feel like a partisan while you were doing your research on video cassette recorders? What I'm thinking of is this. Your father is Ring Lardner Jr., the screenwriter whose credits include the screenplay for MASH. And I don't know how much you grew up within the Hollywood background, but did you have a kind of built-in identification there with actors and screenwriters?
Well, actors and screenwriters don't all think alike, you know.
Well,
Francis Ford Coppola took a stand against the official movie industry stand maybe 7-8 years ago. He said, you know, I think the VCRs are fine. Let people tape movies, you know. He figured that sooner or later the artists would reap some of the reward, and I think he was shown to be right on this point.
Do you think that screenwriters should get royalties and actors should get royalties for the tapes that we watch at home?
Well, you know, the irony is there was this huge fight waged between the movie industry and the electronics industry over just this issue. It was resolved in favor of unrestricted taping, and the movie industry has no right to collect payments for the rental of each movie. Of course, each cassette that winds up in a store has to be bought from the studios, assuming it's an authorized cassette, and some of that money does presumably filter its way back to the writers and so forth. But there are a few European countries that do pay copyright royalties for what they do is they charge a little royalty on the sale of each machine and the sale of each tape. And that money is then distributed either back to copyright owners on some kind of prorated basis, or it's distributed, used for public support for the arts. There is no indication, as far as I can tell, that society is significantly hurt or helped with either system. It doesn't really seem to matter a whole lot, although lawyers and lobbyists in the United States were happy to spend millions of dollars litigating this issue.
Well, I'm wondering if in America there were copyright royalties on home video rentals. Would the money have gone to the artists involved in the making of the movie, or would it have just gone to the studios who produced it or distributed it?
It would go to the studios who produced it in this sense. Movies are called works for hire, and in legal terms, the author of the movie is usually the movie company that owns the copyright, and it's up to the writer or the director to negotiate a contract with that movie company that assures that writer or director of payment in X or Y circumstance. Otherwise, it just goes to the movie company.
So probably the movie company would have gotten most of the money?
Well, I'd say the movie company would get most of the money, except that there are a lot of sort of superstars who have a lot of bargaining leverage, and they can get pretty much anything they want.
Your father is still a screenwriter.
Yes.
And now he was one of the Hollywood 10. He was mm-hmm. one of the people blacklisted for refusing to respond to questions in the UAC hearings, the House on American Activities Committee hearings. Did you see any recurring characters in the story that you're telling of the video cassette revolution controversy, characters that were part of the controversy surrounding the Hollywood 10?
You mean individuals?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, in Hollywood, you can't look to see anybody who wielded any power more than 5 years ago wielding power now. between the time that this whole issue got started, while Universal sued Sony over the right of videotaping in 1976, and Sidney Sheinberg, who is the president of MCA and Universal, their one company, is about the only Hollywood executive who is still in a position of power and was 10 years ago.
So I guess not then. Well, we have time for one short story before we have to end. You talk a little bit about video piracy, and you have this great story about a videotape of the Rambo movie.
Oh, right. Well, outside the United States, there has been a tremendous amount of video piracy, and one movie that was widely available in a pirated form was Rambo in the Middle East, and in Cyprus in particular. Only apparently for political reasons, the story was unacceptable, having Russians as the villains, and Vietnam was a little touchy. So they simply conveniently reset the movie in World War II in the Philippines, even though there are these, you know, jets and ultra-modern helicopters and other equipment that is visibly not of World War II vintage. And they have the whole story retold, and the villains are the Japanese in World War II.
So instead of saying you really made quite a name for yourself in Vietnam, it becomes you made a name for yourself in Guadalcanal.
Exactly.
Did you get to see any tapes like that?
Well, no, I didn't see that one, right?
I'd love to see it. So do you have a video cassette recorder? Do you watch a lot of movies at home? How do you use it?
My biggest use of it is to watch New York Mets games. And I can tell you that, first of all, to do this, you have to go through the day rigorously avoiding people who might know the score so that you can keep yourself in suspense until you see the ball game. That's the first ordeal. And the second is the deep moral question. Is it right or is it not right to fast forward through a slow part of the game?
Oh, that's not right.
I agree with you.
James Lardner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with James Lardner. He's written a book that examines the video cassette revolution. It's titled Fast Forward, and it's published by Norton. This is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with film and television director Alan Arkush. His film credits include Rock and Roll High School, starring the Ramones, and Get Crazy. His TV credits include L.A. Law, St. Elsewhere, and Moonlighting. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, director Tim Hunter talks about his new movie, River's Edge. Based on a true story, the film follows a group of teenagers torn between loyalty to a friend who's just murdered his girlfriend and their guilt over not going to the police. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new album by pianist Steve Kuhn. Francis says Kuhn's come a long way since his early performances with John Coltrane 25 years ago. TV critic David Bianculli says ABC made a big mistake by canceling Our World, the network's weekly look at the past. And we'll get a look at the present from NPR News in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. We have our weekly jazz review now with music critic Francis Davis. Jazz pianist Steve Kuhn has been making music for over 25 years. He's played with many well-known musicians, but his solo career has never taken him to the top. Francis says only now is Kuhn really coming into his own.
Jazz musicians who don't become famous often become answers to trivia questions about the ones who do. Take Steve Kuhn, for example. He was the pianist in the John Coltrane Quartet before McCoy Tyner. That was in 1960 when Kuhn was 22. He never recorded with Coltrane, but he did make albums with Stan Getz, Kenny Dorham, and Art Farmer, among others, later in the decade. In the 1970s, Kuhn suffered a kind of identity crisis. In this, he was not unique. Jazz itself was suffering an identity crisis at the time. First, Kuhn switched to electric keyboards. Then, after pulling the plug, so to speak, he wrote mopey art songs. But Kuhn has regained his form on two recent albums. The first is Life's Magic on Black Hawk Records. It was recorded live at New York's Village Vanguard. It features Kuhn with bassist Ron Carter and drummer Al Foster. You heard a little bit of it earlier. Despite the expansive nature of its performances, what's finally so pleasing about Life's Magic is how much these three veteran musicians trust to inference. It's a pleasure hearing them telegraph rhythms and melodies to one another. But Kuhn's other new album is even more remarkable. It's self-descriptively titled Mostly Ballads, and it's on New World Records. It's evenly divided between Kuhn piano solos and duets with bassist Harvey Swartz. The program includes pop standards like How High the Moon and Body and Soul, as well as jazz standards like Ergen and Round Midnight. It's one of the albums I might pull off the shelf to show how a sensitive improviser can bring autobiographical meditation to bear on songs that belong to no one in particular at this point. But not only that, some of the performances on Mostly Ballads also show how a sensitive improviser can rehabilitate treacle. Here's an example, Steve Kuhn's version of a song not usually thought of as a jazz vehicle, the old Patti Page hit Tennessee Waltz. From the album Mostly Ballads, pianist Steve Kuhn's surprisingly shapely reading of Tennessee Waltz. Actually, Kuhn's affinity for such material isn't really such a surprise. 20 years ago, he recorded an entire album of country ballads with fellow pianist Toshiko Akiyoshi. What might surprise some people, though, but really shouldn't, is that Steve Kuhn has made the best album of his career at the age of 47. Some time ago, the influential French jazz critic André Hodier wrote an essay called Why Do They Age So Badly? In it, he bemoaned the inevitable decline of jazz musicians as they approached middle age. One of his targets was Roy Eldridge, who was all of 39 at the time. My point here isn't to ridicule Hodier, but rather to suggest that, for whatever variety of reasons, it takes some musicians longer to blossom than others. Steve Kuhn is a good example of a musician who was well worth waiting for.
Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. He also writes about jazz for The Atlantic and the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Tim Hunter. He's the director of the new film, River's Edge. It's the story of a teenage boy who kills his girlfriend, tells his friends about the deed, then invites them to view the corpse where he left it at the river's edge. For 2 days, they keep his secret. Dennis Hopper plays an ex-biker who killed his girlfriend 20 years ago. He's a hermit who lets the teenage murderer hide out at his place. The film is loosely based on a real event that took place in 1981 in a suburban Northern California town. The screenplay was written soon after the incident by a then 21-year-old California film student named Neil Jimenez. Director Tim Hunter had worked with teenagers before, directing them in the films Tex and Sylvester, and co-authoring the screenplay for Over the Edge. But he had called it quits on teenage movies. I asked Hunter what then interested him in the script for River's Edge.
Here are these kids. They have almost... nothing to go on in life except a kind of media-induced code not to narc on their friends. And here comes this event, which is such an enormous catalyst in their lives that they don't know how to handle. And with that, the treatment of it in the script seemed quite complicated. I liked, for example, that... Matt, the kid that you would have to peg as the hero of the piece, nonetheless is the kid who does narc, who goes to the cops, and he has to live with the ambiguities of that all his life. And Lane, played by Crispin Glover, who represents the worst impulses of the group, nonetheless stands for friendship and loyalty in a crazy kind of way. I like stories that aren't all black and all white, that deal with contradictions. I think in life when you make decisions and learn and grow by those decisions, there's always a trade-off. You choose something, and in doing so, you give up something else. And this piece of material seemed just ripe with the paradoxes of real life.
The story is in part about how parents, teachers, the cops, all of the adult authority figures don't understand the teenagers and don't offer any kind of satisfactory role models. Did you feel that you were in a position of really understanding yourself as an adult, what was going through the minds of the teenagers in the story?
Well, it's hard to identify with kids who are that feel that disenfranchised, who are that disassociated from any semblance of society. But I did feel a lot of compassion for them. I think that although it's a cool and dispassionate screenplay that Neil wrote for this film, that it does have a heart and a lot of feeling for the kids. So the actors and I, spent a lot of time talking about where we thought the emotions really lay in the characters, and how people felt as opposed to how they translated those feelings into actions.
One of the most riveting performances that you get in River's Edge is from an actor who I think is 12 years old, and this kid is ready to kill the person who snitched to the cops. He's totally amoral and pretty vicious. How did you work with him to get such a really tough performance?
Well, I'm not sure. Joshua Miller, who you're talking about, he's just one of these kids. You'd have to call him a natural. When the camera stops, he's a cute, innocent, somewhat naive seeming 12 year old, and then when you say action, all of a sudden he's totally in character. The part, Timmy, certainly an evil little kid, and Joshua plays it to a T.
I think this was the first role for several of the teenagers in the movie. Is it difficult to direct teenagers? And I'm thinking that when you're directing an adult, they've experienced a lot of life. With teenagers, they've probably seen more life on television and movies than they've seen firsthand.
Yeah. Well, adults sometimes also have more preconceptions than the kids, which makes the kids a pleasure to work with. I think I have a theory on this, which is that if the script is good, if the parts are good, then you're going to find good people to play them. If the parts are kind of amorphous, if it's Hollywood formula, you could have almost any actor in the part, then that's when you have a tough time.
Dennis Hopper gives a really spellbinding performance in the movie. He's possessed in the role of psychos when he plays them. The role of Feck is an ex-biker who shot his girlfriend to death years ago, who now lives as a hermit in an old broken-down house, and the thing that he's closest to is an inflatable sex doll who you see him waltzing around with and talking to. Dennis Hopper had a reputation of being on a lot of drugs, being difficult and unreliable to work with. Did you have any qualms about working with him in this movie?
Dennis is a very brave actor. There aren't very many people that tackle fringe characters like this, that continue to want to work on the cutting edge, on the avant-garde, and it's not just neurosis on his part. I think it's really bravery, and Dennis was in very good shape, as he tells all the magazines. We knew he was in good shape. He was wonderful on the set. The kids loved him because of who he is and all the history that he brings with him. And I had a fine time with him. We agreed that Feck's character sort of goes through radical changes from line to line, let alone scene to scene, and that we were going to go for a lot of different shadings and try to put them together in post-production into a coherent performance. And so we experimented quite a bit on the set and had a lot of fun with each other, I think.
The camera keeps going back to the dead body, to the teenage girl who has been strangled by her boyfriend. And as the hours wear on and the days go by, the body is turning bluer. You decided to use a real actor as this dead body as opposed to, say, a mannequin. What were the advantages of actually casting somebody to play a dead body?
We wanted the audience to feel that this was a real person who had been killed by another real person. We really wanted the audience to feel the loss of a human life, not just a movie death. And so there was no way we could have used a mannequin for any of that stuff. All the shots of the body that you're talking about were written into the original script exactly as they appear in the film, and it was interesting to me because the descriptions of the body in the script were much more romantic. Neil would write stuff like, "Is she perhaps even more beautiful now in death than she was in life?" And I didn't entirely want to lose that darkly romantic, I call it Ophelia-like quality to the body, and yet we didn't want to romanticize it really in any way because the event was such a horrifying event. So we did a fair amount of research in forensic text. I went to a morgue, talked to policemen, and the photographic treatment of the body is sort of influenced by classical studies of nudes and, you know, and various sort of artistic things, and yet the makeup is quite clinical, quite graphic and clinical.
Do you think the actress felt that it was a ghoulish role to take on?
Well, we were fortunate enough to find a very smart L.A. punk who thought it would be cool to play dead for a week.
Although River's Edge is about teenagers, it doesn't fit in to any of the teenage genre movie categories. It's not a sex comedy. It's not a kind of blood and guts horror film. It's a really powerful, very serious film. I mean, there's sex in it and there's violence in it, but it's much more powerful, I think, than your average horror movie is. Were people concerned? Were your producers concerned about who the market was going to be for this movie?
Yeah, well, nobody ever felt that River's Edge was anyone's idea of a commercial picture. We made a decision very early, really, when we decided to get together and try to get the film made. We made a decision to make it as inexpensively as possible as a low-budget independent feature.
And I like that there's not a kind of made-for-TV movie type ending.
Yeah, because they always have to pick, you know, the evil are punished and the good is rewarded, and it's such a simplistic moral position that people get titillated by the exciting subject matter, but they're allowed to view it from the most comfortable, secure, you know, perspective. And the River's Edge pulls all those rugs out from under you. You know, it's not an easy film to watch.
Tim Hunter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Tim Hunter is the director of the new film, River's Edge. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
We're following the International Conference on AIDS in Washington, D.C., also following up on the killing of the Lebanese Prime Minister Rashid Karami, and talking with Seymour Hersh, the journalist, about Soviet air defenses. He wrote the book on flight KAL-7, and we'll ask him what he makes of the plane that landed in Red Square.
How are you celebrating the 20th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's?
We're talking to a group of old friends who've been come back to the old house where they used to sit around back in the 60s and see what they made of the past 20 years.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The ABC television show Our World gave a personal perspective to historical events from the mid-1930s to the mid-1970s. But now the show is history itself. ABC has canceled Our World. It will go into repeats this week, but our television critic David Bianculli thinks the show shouldn't have been so dispensable to the network.
Here comes some more bad news. Less than a month after NBC canceled Hill Street Blues, ABC has decided to cancel Our World. Last week was the show's final original telecast, the last time Linda Ellerbe and Ray Gandolf would guide viewers down memory lane. The difference between the two situations is that the absence of Hill Street still leaves NBC with a roster of great shows. Saint Elsewhere, L.A. Law, Cheers, The Cosby Show, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. ABC, though, doesn't have any good hours to spare. Once Our World leaves, ABC will have only Moonlighting and Max Headroom in the quality category. And that's not enough. Moonlighting cranked out only 15 episodes last season, and Max Headroom vanished after 6. By contrast, there were 22 original hours of Our World last season, more than Moonlighting and Max Headroom put together. By simple mathematics, that means ABC has just canceled 50% of its weekly quality TV shows. What makes Our World so good? Instead of trying to be an encyclopedia, it's more like a diary, and it really makes each era come alive. The images are great, the use of music is really clever, and the writing is, in a word, superb. The best part of Our World is always saved for last when Ellerbe and Gandolf sit on stools and deliver brief monologues. Here's what Gandolf had to say about the winter of 1968.
It was not just the reality of the Vietnam War that soured Lyndon Johnson's presidency. Americans had been dying in Vietnam when Eisenhower was president and would still be dying there under Gerald Ford. What changed that winter was our perception of the war. There was a new awareness that we would have to give more to the war to win it or settle for less than victory.
Ellerbe's strong suit is poking fun at life in general and the media in particular. My favorite essay of hers concerned the 1938 broadcast of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, which set off a nationwide panic when listeners tuned in late and thought they were hearing news reports of a real Martian invasion. Ellerbe called the incident the first recorded instance of zapping. Zapping is Madison Avenue slang for the act of people switching to another program when a commercial comes on. That's precisely what happened on Halloween night in 1938, when fans of NBC's Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy switched over to CBS and Orson Welles and freaked out. Listen to Ellerbe's assessment of that absurd but actual Halloween scare.
Now, how could people smart enough to figure out zapping be dumb enough to fall for the Martian hoax? Sure, part of it was that the whole world was being scared and all, but there's another explanation. All you really need to know is that the most popular program in the nation starred a ventriloquist on the radio. And so it goes.
Last week, Ellerbe said, "And so it goes," as her final sign-off, just as she had for the final episode of NBC News Overnight and the final episode of Weekend. She and Gandalf said goodbye with spunk and with grace, but I'm upset they had to say goodbye at all. Our world, after all, was up against NBC's The Cosby Show, the highest-rated show on television. So it wasn't surprising that Our World was last season's lowest-rated TV show. The show ABC put against Cosby two seasons ago was Shadow Chasers, which got an even lower rating than Our World. What was surprising about Our World was that it was so good. If ABC is going to lose the time slot anyway, why not lose it with style and with substance? Next season, Our World will be replaced by Sledgehammer and the Charmings, which is kind of like replacing Bill Moyers with Soupy Sales. Viewers deserve better.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Also in the autumn of 1938,
the first Jefferson nickel went into circulation, replacing the old Indian head buffalo nickel.
The first nylon toothbrush was introduced.
In Switzerland, the Nestle company introduced Nescafé.
On October 22nd, in Astoria, Queens, Chester Carlson produced the first Xerox image.
Here's a preview of tomorrow's show. On our next program, I'll speak with photographer Abigail Heyman. She's been the unofficial photographer at dozens of weddings. Her new book gives a different view of marriage than any wedding album you'll see. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will examine Nashville's reaction to rock. And book critic John Leonard will review Moscow 2042 by Vladimir Voinovich. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.